Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrent Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lautha, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrent Studies. The NY Deterrent Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast, the podcast of the NY Deterrent Center. You know, we've had a lot of great guests on NucleCast over the last, I guess it's we're coming up on 3 years now. So why would I break with tradition? And so, of course, I've got another great guest. I'm talking about Dr. Michaela Dodge, who is a research scholar at the National Institute for Public Policy. And she's written a new article that, of course, you guys, the listeners, need to check out. It's called Russia Is at War with the West. And, you know, Michaela, first of all, welcome to NucleCast. It's good to see you again.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back.
And, you know, you've got another, a longer occasional paper that is talks about, this one's a little bit older than your newest one, but it talks about, you know, domestic division and how that impacts our ability to have successful foreign policy and assure allies. So that one's also out there. So people should go check that one out as well. But, you know, in speaking of this newest article, sort of give us an abstract of what is the fundamental argument that you make.
Well, the fundamental argument really is that when your adversary is telling you that he is at war with you, you should listen and you should prepare and plan and counter accordingly. What has really been bothering me is seeing the increase in Russia's belligerence over the past, 15 or perhaps a little more than that years, and us continuing to talk about it as if it was, as if Russia was just kind of little nuisance, but not really meaning it, and as if we didn't have to treat Russia's threats seriously. And I think the calling Russia's activities against NATO hybrid warfare or, actions below the threshold of war, that is all part of that. It's giving us false impression of not being at war with Russia.
So I don't know if you remember, some of our listeners will remember, in the old Joint Publication 5 on planning, there was that, that sort of almost like a bell curve type chart. And, there's peace, and then there's the five phases of war, and then war ends. And so Americans seem to have this perception of war that, there's peace, then kinetics happens, then we do some stuff, then we win, and then we go back to peace. And they don't seem to understand that the Russians and the Chinese don't think that, and that they're at, they're at constant war with their adversaries, and that they're just using different methods of, waging that war, and that it's not necessarily this nice chart where war starts and ends. Is that something, at least that's my take on, as I've observed how we look at the Russians and the Chinese, how do you see it in terms of the American perspective versus the Russian or Chinese perspective?
I think one of the most important things that we have to keep in mind is it is us who decides where the threshold of war is, right? And so I think part of my plea in this paper is let's call Russia's activities what they are, which is, an extension of war against the United States and against NATO. Because if we cannot explain to the American people, and if NATO country governments cannot explain to their people why it is that they're not in peace, they cannot expect support for increases in defense spending that we just so badly need to strengthen deterrence.
Yeah, it's Is it because, and I think this is probably, you know, a long time challenge for us, is that most Americans don't feel it, right? It doesn't hit home. It's, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, most Americans didn't feel it. You know, it's military service members are less than 1% of the population. They're, you know, and then it's, you know, my ancestor served and then I serve and then my son's going to go into the Navy. And so it tends to be the same sort of sets of families that do it. And so for the vast majority of Americans, they don't feel Russia at war with them. And so therefore they think to themselves, this is no big deal. If they want to say they're at war, it's not a problem. What are we worried about? I'm going to go ahead and, you know, watch Netflix or, you know, work, or I got to take the kids to soccer. And that's sort of what's enabled the U.S. to not feel the repercussions of war in a way that, let's say, you know, the Baltic states do or the Poles do. Is there something else to it? And am I missing something?
No, I don't think you are. I think it's just really hard for democracies to mobilize for war until they feel threatened themselves. And you see this pattern in American history where before First World War, before we entered the First World War, we were just negligently unprepared to enter that conflict. Even though we had information and we had understanding of what that war is looking like, we did not prepare. You saw the same thing with the Second World War, where, you know, instantly after Versailles Treaty was signed, Germany started to violate it on large scale. And that those violations and that deception grew worse until Hitler decided not to bother. You saw same dynamics in the UK. So, you know, we don't have to pick just on Americans all the time. I just think it's very hard for democracies to mobilize. But one thing that certainly makes it more difficult is if you don't call spade to spade. If you are thinking that, you know, the competition with Russia or China, if we talk about it the same way as we talk about a Sunday soccer match, as if the consequences of whether we win or lose don't matter, that's where we really are in trouble.
Yeah. So, you know, this may be in part sort of the asymmetric interests of us and the Russians. Can you maybe talk for a minute about why are the Russians at war with us, and why are they at war with the West? What is their perception of why they need to be at war with us?
It's a very tough question, and I'm not expert on Russia's strategic culture. My sense has been that fundamentally Russia is an imperial empire, and it will feel threatened unless its borders are not expanding. You also have Russia that has wounded pride from losing the Cold War. And Putin has said so much. He sees the end of the Cold War the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, which is very different from how the end of the Cold War is viewed in most of the areas of the former Warsaw Pact countries. And so you have this fundamental disagreement over how the world order should be organized and where boundaries of Russia's influence should be. I think that's really at the heart of it. I do not think that Russia feels particularly threatened by NATO's expansion or by anything that NATO does, because if it did feel threatened, it would not withdraw almost all of its soldiers away from NATO borders to go to fight in Ukraine.
Yeah, after the invasion of Ukraine, I started reading a bunch of the, you know, more recent biographies on Putin. And, you know, my minor as a graduate student was Russian history. And so I can't help but think that in Putin's mind, his view is that, you know, we've been invaded, you know, I think 6 or 8 times in the last 400 years by the Swedes, the Poles, the French, the Germans. The East European plain is, you know, big and flat. The Russians are going to fall back. That's sort of their method of war. They take a lot of casualties. They fall back. They move back east. And eventually we're going to, you know, we will fight you. And then we will, you know, we will use up your energy and your forces. And then the winter comes and then you'll pull out and eventually we'll win. And, you know, by virtue of, and there's some, you know, one of the arguments has been, was that we, the Americans, never promised the Russians that we wouldn't go beyond, you know, the German border. That, you know, that's sort of been a debate. And I think the debate's fairly settled that, you know, the Secretary of State for, you know, George H.W. Bush did in fact sort of make a verbal promise that they wouldn't move east. I think there's good evidence that, and in his biography, the more recent biography, James Baker, that he did say that. And so the Russians, I think, do have a sense of insecurity. You know, it's part their culture. They are, you know, as I've dealt with Russians, they are a people who are, they just can't believe, like when we, the Americans, say we don't want anything from the Russians, they can't believe that. They're conspiratorial by nature. And so I wonder, am I viewing the Russians incorrectly as I read them? I'm not saying that they're necessarily right, that we want, you know, to take Russian lands or that NATO wants to invade and destroy Russia. But I do think they probably have a ingrained perception that might be the case, whether obviously you and I would generally agree it's not a valid one, but it's their sort of inbred conspiracy.
I mean, I think they use it as a really useful rhetorical device, and you've seen it circulating in the narratives, you know, since NATO's enlargement, right? Again, to me, like, if I look at where their forces are, they're not on NATO borders, even since Finland joined. If they were really as scared of NATO's invasion as they are, their force deployments would look different. So I don't buy it as much as the Russians try to sell it. And then, you know, there is the other question where, even if you do accept that logic, I mean, it does not flow that it's in our interest to accept Russia subjugating Ukraine and invading Baltics and going back to Czechoslovakia or, you know, the Czech Republic and Slovakia today. In a sense, I mean, I don't know what to do with that rhetorical device. Like, I don't think it's empirically true. And even if it was true, it's still not in our interest to let Russian expansion run rampart and redraw the boundaries of the post-Cold War order.
So let's say we agree on that. What is, you know, with America, you know, the biggest problem for the United States, right? I wrote a book chapter here recently, and my argument in the book chapter was, hey, you can't solve strategic problems until you solve domestic spending problems. And, you know, the thing I pointed out was that our three largest, if you look at our entitlement programs here in the U.S., it's 100%. If you entitlement, it's about $4 trillion a year. Then you add national debt, it's another $900 billion. That was 100% of federal revenue last year. So entitlements and debt are 100% of your intake, your revenue. And you can't really build a world-class military. And it's grown exponentially, you know, since 1990. Even if you go back to when the wall fell, and you look at the data on domestic entitlement spending, it's skyrocketed. And so the question is, it's, you know, people always talk about, can we put the genie back in the bottle with nuclear weapons? My question is, can we put the genie back in the bottle with entitlement spending? Because you're never going to build the military that's able to both deal with Russia and, let's say, China or somebody else, as long as every defense dollar you spend is borrowed money. I don't know how you do it. So my argument has been, you've got to deal with the one before you deal with the other.
I mean, I agree with you conceptually. You know, realistically, the problem is that there is just no political will whatsoever to rein in entitlements from either of the parties. I think we don't have good communicators in general that would explain that the United States has strong military and deployments abroad, so it would not have to fight at home. That's really the fundamental purpose of the U.S. alliance structure after the Second World War. And it took us two world wars to learn that lesson. We forget it in the meantime. Obviously I agree with you. I mean, you could zero out Department of Defense tomorrow and it would not make that much of a dent on your entitlements and federal debt. And that's really the discussion that we should be having.
Isn't it then incumbent upon those of us who sort of say, hey, you know, listen, the Russians and the Chinese are a big problem and it'll impact, you know, the U.S. economy in the long term. It'll impact, you know, for example, if the U.S. dollar ceases to become the, you know, the currency of trade, that'll impact the U.S. economy in a very negative way. You know, that's consistently allowed us to, you know, to inflate, you know, quantitative easing and inflate the amount of dollars, you know, available without actually seeing the value of the dollar decline. It's because it's a currency of trade and people want a stable dollar. But if we don't spend the money that it takes to sort of deter Russia, China, and all these others, and we lose that sort of central role, then it's going to impact all of those other things that people value as well. And how do we sort of make the case that Russia is the problem and that it's worth, you know, shifting dollars away from, you know, let's say domestic programs to these national security programs? Because that's really what has to be done in order to sort of accomplish the effective deterrence of Russia.
I think you're right. We have to make that argument better collectively, but it's also not just a defense argument, you know, it's also an argument about why is it not a good idea to live in debt? Why is it not a good idea to spend more than you earn? Why is it a good idea to plan for your retirement? so it really is, you know, more fundamental problem than strategic discussion about why deterring Russia or China is important. That's part of it. But once you broaden that question into the sort of entirety of the government spending, it very quickly becomes a values discussion on what it is that the founding fathers intended when they laid foundations for the republic and how we've just went further and further away from those intentions and ideas.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLAW Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And I think this kind of goes back in part to your, you know, the earlier monograph you wrote where you talk about, you know, just how bad American politics have gotten in, you know, because we do live in a vitriolic sort of system. We've seen that with the assassination of Charlie Kirk and then how people on different sides of the political aisle have responded we can really see the polarization that you talked about in that earlier monograph. And then as we look at this and we look at, you know, as I talk to, you know, my colleagues in South Korea and Japan and Australia and other places, and they're trying to decide how do they handle, you know, what is President Trump going to do? And in some respects, and you talk about this, about, hey, they just don't understand, they don't particularly understand American foreign policy well and how it operates and the impact of presidents and how policy shifts occur when political parties, you know, switch. And so, you know, that's part of this, I think, larger challenge too. So it, none of it operates in isolation. So for somebody who's written about both the problem in a strategic sense and the problem sort of domestically, what would you say we need to be doing?
As you know, I've spent a long time thinking about this because you really do see polarization. It's a built-in feature of our system. When you need to mobilize the median voter, as many median voters as you can to win elections, you are going to look for the cleavages in the society and mobilize along those lines, and who gets most voters fired up wins. It's become a lot more sinister ever since the rise of the social media and the algorithms that sort of feed into your preconceived notions. And so as you, in your social media bubble, encounter only opinions that you agree with, that becomes the norm, even if your opinions are way out there and not part of the mainstream. And, you know, my good friend working this issue gives an example of a village idiot who goes to a pub, says something outrageous, everybody else tells him you're an idiot, and he kind of self-corrects, and they have a beer and continue the debate. Well, now that village idiot goes on to an internet pub, says something completely outrageous, and everybody pats him on the back and tells him how smart he is. And so you lose, in a sense, that self-correcting mechanism where now we just have a hard time agreeing even on sort of basic fundamental truths. And so when I was thinking about this problem, I always came to a conclusion that just fundamentally you have to change U.S. education system. You have to go back to give people foundation in historical facts. You have to teach them how to conduct an argument. You have to give them language to understand what the argument is and what's the limits of that argument, or what are the limits of your own understanding of the problem. You have to, you know, teach people how to read well and read more widely, read the classics. And so, again, way out of my sort of expertise, but that has been my sense as it comes to polarization, because it's not in any sense self-correcting problem. The other thing that I think to some degree could correct it, but it's going to cost us a lot, is if the United States is under an attack. And I think in that case, you could see a decrease in polarization. But also at that point, you'll be mobilizing for conflict that you probably did not see coming and that you did not prepare for, as is kind of a pattern in U.S. history. So I do not relish those potential prospects.
Yeah, I think you're right. I forget the name of the book, but I think she was a professor at Harvard or somewhere, and she wrote a great book on social media, and then they did a documentary, and it talked about exactly what you were talking about, how the algorithms sort of feed into you as an individual, your biases, and they reinforce your biases. And that, you know, this is a relatively new phenomenon because you and I both have kids, and those kids, you know, my kids are a little older than yours, but they're sort of the first generation of kids who grew up with a smartphone. And, you know, they're used to, you know, I don't allow them to have social media, but they're constantly telling me, they're both teenagers now, and they're constantly telling me that, you know, hey, Dad. I'm like, hey, you know, Wyatt, he's my son, he's almost 16. And he's like, hey, can I get, you know, Instagram? And I'm like, well, why do you need Instagram? Well, because this girl asked me for my Insta handle or whatever. And I said, I didn't have one. And so therefore, you know, we don't talk. And I'm like, well, why didn't you just get her phone number and you can call her? And then it's like, he's like, that's not how people don't actually talk to each other, Dad. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What does this world come to? I thought the point of phones was so you could talk to people. And, you know, so therefore it goes back to your point that we sort of go off into bubbles, and then we talk to the people who agree with us. And then we feel, and I think this is sort of part of what the Charlie Kirk thing has demonstrated, is that everybody's reinforcing our, you know, biases and hatreds. And then you think, well, it's obviously legitimate to assassinate somebody I disagree with. Everybody's telling me it's okay. And so therefore, and you know, if you think about Russian active measures, the Russians have to be loving what's going on in the United States right now, because for anybody familiar with Marcuse, Herbert Marcuse, a neo-Marxist who, you know, focused on trying to destroy the United States, his whole thing was you got to create cleavages in our society. That's how you topple the U.S. And so it goes sort of back to your initial point on, you know, the Russian threat and then how they're at war with us. This is one of the ways they're at war with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we give them a good deal of help. Again, I am sure the Russians are loving it. But I'm also sure that we do enough damage ourselves where, you know, you don't necessarily, as sometimes it's this narrative that, like, Russians are this so powerful manipulators of U.S. public opinion. No, it's still you going to the election booth, and it's still you casting your vote exactly the way you want to. Now, whether you can see through that you are being manipulated one way or another, that's a different question. And yes, there is Russian culpability, but, like, at the end of the day, you are responsible for these things, not anyone else.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point. So, you know, kind of, as you think through it, what do you see? Is there sort of a grand solution, or is it sort of a realization among the American people that, hey, this is more important than, you know, the next, I don't know, whatever TV show people watch, the next episode of that TV show, or, you know, whatever thing keeps you playing video games. You know, you give up some video games. What is it that needs to be done?
What are we solving now? We have, like, five different problems that we talked about. So which one of them are you trying to solve?
Kind of, you're going back to your original issue of the Russians are at war with us and we don't know it and we don't seem to think about it or care about it. How do we change that?
Well, first, let's start saying it. You know, let's stop talking about gray zone. Let's stop talking about hybrid. Let's start talking about Russia invaded Russia attacked our close ally Poland. Russia attacked our close ally Romania. Russia invaded Ukraine, to which we pledge security guarantees. If we do not uphold those security guarantees, which we are not, our allies are going to question our credibility as guarantor of their own security. That might mean that the United States will have less spacing access. The United States may need to deal with proliferation of nuclear weapons. The United States may need to deal with more regional instability and emboldened adversaries. All of those things are bad for the economy. They're bad for the United States. They're you know, they can have negative repercussions in spiraling in actual conflict in which the United States homeland gets attacked. And if we do get attacked, it's going to be awful because we are not preparing our homeland whatsoever. That's generally how I would recommend just going about it. Just, we really need that Winston Churchill that is going to say, hey, this is what is going on. It's really not that hard to see. These are the indicators. What we need is X, Y, and Z. We need strong nuclear deterrent. We need missile defense, comprehensive missile defense for the homeland, for our allies. We need to modernize our conventional forces.
Yeah. Okay, so we're getting late in the show, so I want to bring out Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp, Bob grants you three wishes, so long as they're on the topics we've discussed. And thankfully, I expanded the range of topics today, so you have a lot of things you can wish for.
Oh,
so with that in mind, Michaela, what is your first wish?
Oh, you did not tell me this was coming. So I'll have to think about it. Comprehensive, strong, layered missile defense system in space.
Okay. So do you want it both terrestrial and space-based, or are you wanting like rods from God, lasers, or, you know, what does this look like? Give me a kind of a quick synopsis.
I honestly don't care as long as it works. My sense is that, you know, you have to go to space. Lasers are probably going to be tough to do at this point, or tougher to do than small kinetic kill vehicles. But hey, it's the genie, right? I can ask for whatever.
You can wish. Exactly. Okay, so that's wish number one. So how about wish number two?
Wish number two. I mean, we did talk a lot about education, and I do wish we did have better educational system K-9, where you have comprehensive classical education with good foundations in history and logic. Because really, that's going to be future voters, future citizens, future leaders of this country. There's probably no single more important issue than that. Just how your kids are educated and what it is that they're learning. Number three, can I wish for like peace on Earth? You know, it's probably it's right up there with space-based lasers.
Well, I mean, you know, ultimately the whole point of deterrence is to promote peace, right? That's why we want to, you know, see vis pacem para bellum. If you desire peace, prepare for war.
That's the point of preparing for war, yeah.
Yeah, so world peace. Thank you, Miss America, for that wish. You know, it's funny you mentioned education, and I could not agree more. I would encourage our listeners to go look at what the state of Arizona has done, because they've seen the largest gains in educational outcomes of any state. And the way they've done it is they have a certain allocation for every child, you know, let's say $8,000. And then whatever that child does, you know, a government school, a private school, a charter school, homeschool, whatever it is, the money follows the child. And so what they've seen is they've seen about half of students leave the government education system, go to a variety of other forms. And what you're seeing is the government schools are actually getting a lot better, because they now face true competition. And so you're seeing all forms of schooling get better and more competitive. And you're seeing, you know, that's what capitalism does, is it you know, it creates competition and things get better. And so therefore they are, and students in Arizona are doing better. They're no longer, they were 48th. Now they're moving up. I think they were like 25th the last time I looked. So they're doing a lot better. So That was one where I just thought, you know, Michaela, there is a solution. It's from Arizona and it works. So, okay. So for your kind of, you know, drop the mic, walk off the stage, sort of what's that thing you want our listeners to know and remember, you know, 6 months or a year from now, and just remember, you know, hey, that was a point Michaela made that's just stuck with me.
I think the most important point from this conversation is that there are adversaries who are telling us that they're at war with us, and we'd better believe them and organize and plan accordingly.
Yeah, fair. We can't dismiss our adversaries.
No, they get a choice. They get a choice.
All right, Michaela Dodge, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.